episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, we have a sponsor this hour, Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere ag and turf dealer, and they can do everything John Deere. If you need a tractor or mower, implements, you name it, go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call, 226-9226, and just tell them what you're looking for. They'll fix you up. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. There you go.
Ta-da. Let's see. Who gets free advertising of the week?
Well, I don't know. I guess we should have talked about that. I love it when she does that. Nothing like dead air on the radio.
I like just looking at Bill.
Yeah.
Do it.
No.
Sit.
No.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, we'll work on free advertising of the week. We'll do that next break. We'll wrangle that out. I'm pretty sure I know who it is, though, but I've got to look up their phone number. Otherwise, it's not really free advertising. It's just chit-chat. So we have a fun show today. We actually have people in the studio 2 weeks in a row, which is weird for us and nice. We are also, let's see, next week. So today is November 20th. So on the 27th, we're running an archive because the studio shut down. But it'll be a blast from the past. I think you'll like it. Actually, she was a really interesting lady, and we should have her on again. Be Elaine Willman from Montana. But today in real life, we have Professor Dan Sloan, alias Dr. Daniel Sloan. You could morph those two together. And let's see, he sent me a fun bio. And actually, the bio created questions, more questions than I had, because I only see him, you know, at some meetings and stuff, and I didn't know. Like, I'm really caught in the extreme sport thing. I need to know more. He directs Simpson University's Master of Organizational Leadership program and teaches undergraduate business administration and computer information systems. So I mean, that would keep most people pretty busy. But then he is also a U.S. Department of State specialist with and a Georgetown University fellow, an adjunct professor at Pepperdine University Law School. These are all in different places, Dan. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you're at Simpson University and then at all these different places. His entrepreneurial experience and professional career included decades of business with Fortune 500 companies. Kind of not surprising. That's good. At least you're helping out the private sector because – well, we don't want the government to get all your good work. Mm-hmm. And then in his non-academic life, the one thing I know is that he is on the Republican Central Committee. He represents District 2. But he's also the treasurer on the Good News Mission Board, the rescue mission there. And since I'm the treasurer for the Central Committee, I guess that makes us relatives. Or dum-dums. we're like fellow gluttons for punishment, yes. And he likes to do trekking and extreme sports. Okay, the extreme sports needed like a parenthesis and some detail.
Okay, well, the most recent extreme sport was in Indonesia on a sailboat. It's called a Finnissy sailboat, scuba diving in some incredible water, Komodo Island.
Oh, wow.
Research and a national park. Indonesia has 19,000 islands, and I've lived in that area of the world, so I know it pretty well. Fly into Bali, and then you fly back this way and a couple hundred miles and go to Komodo Island and then get on a sailboat and sail around and see some amazing sea life. I really enjoy skydiving and
trekking
and all kinds of all kinds of really fun stuff. I don't think I ever want to grow old. So,
well, I'm pretty sure with this particular schedule that you've outlined, and that doesn't leave time for any of the other things that I'm sure you're doing, you know, like showering and you know, eating and stuff. But with that kind of list, I'm pretty sure you'll never actually grow old.
Yeah. You've got time.
You're going to outpace it, and with the time travel, around the world, don't you add years to your life or subtract them or however that goes?
Somehow it works out.
Kind of neutralizes.
Oh, that's a different show.
It's enjoyable to keep busy, and it keeps my mind active and besides my body. So,
well, that's great. And so, okay, the deal for today was we don't have a topic, but but Professor Dan's got a million of them. So you can go wherever you like and we'll learn new things.
Well, there's all kinds of really cool stuff that, you know, I've been blessed with an opportunity. Simpson University is my alma mater for my bachelor's degree. I have a bachelor's of arts in psychology and business, dual major. Went on to do some work at Chico State, Golden Gate University, at USC and Harvard. Just had a wide range of academic experiences, and all of those things led to more opportunity, more education that presented opportunities for me. And I've been the kind that if an opportunity came up, if it looked halfway good, I would take it, even though I'm doing something else, which is why I have so much on my plate. So besides...
What's one more thing,
yeah,
right?
One more thing.
You've got like five things. So
who needs to
who
sleep?
Needs six things? Yeah, right.
And so doing a lot of work here in the county. I've had a supply chain and logistics company and marketing. Did business with Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, Bose Stereo, the lottery. And we actually did a voting booth, ballot supply deliveries for logistics for a long time in Shasta County. Yeah, some really amazing stuff there. City Bank in three different states, California, Nevada, and Oregon. As I was going through my education, I dropped out when I was 23 out of Simpson in Shasta, and then came back when I was 26 after I learned I didn't know very much. So I learned the hard way.
I think that's more common than you think.
Yeah, I know now.
You know now what you didn't know.
I know what I didn't know. So, you know, when you're a small business person, entrepreneur, you wear a lot of hats and you make a lot of mistakes. You don't know everything about regulations, the law, human resource issues, marketing, finance, you know, economics. And you have to know how to do a lot of things. If you don't, then you need to know how to hire the people to do them.
Right.
And to emphasize what you're strong in and hire the people that you can trust to do the things you're not. So I've kind of learned a lot along the way. And a little more than 10 years ago, I had an opportunity at the logistics company. I had an opportunity to move to China, mainland China, Zhengzhou, which is now called iPhone City. It's where about 70% of the iPhones are made. A really interesting place. And today's news, because a lot of the people recently have contracted COVID. So the slowdown in COVID manufacturing occurred when in iPhone manufacturing, when COVID hit their city again. I lived there for about a year and had some really interesting experiences there. It's a very hardcore communist location, I arrived there flying in from Redding, California, had never been to China before, had no expectation of what I would get when I arrived there. And I arrived in the middle of the night, about midnight, and started to come down towards the landing, and there was a lot of fog outside. And so I'm watching, and just suddenly
it wasn't fog.
It was smog. And that was my first real experience with really, really heavy duty, industrial grade smog for various reasons, because it is a heavy manufacturing province, Henan province, and because of the burning of agricultural fields and stuff at the simultaneous, just horrible, horrible smog problems.
So besides iPhones, they make other things in that area as well.
Yeah, they're a large bus manufacturer, both combustion and diesel and combustion engine, as well as a lot of electrical. Shenzhen, China, is where a lot of the electrical vehicles are made as well. But they're kind of made all throughout China.
Right. What's the population of that city?
You know, today it's about 12 to 15 million.
Wow.
And it varies because, and that's not a big city. I've lived in Zhengzhou, Guangzhou, Qingdao, in Wuhan, where the virus was from. So I've lived in those four different cities, and each of them varies in size. Guangzhou is in southern China. It's about an hour and a half from Zhuhai or Hong Kong and Macau. So that's about 25, 30 million. So the cities are very, very large.
Yeah. Compared to like L.A., I mean, what do you, 3 million, is it?
7, 8 million.
Oh, 7 million? Yeah, okay, so it's double.
Yeah. I'm there at Pepperdine in Malibu on occasion. Just about every year I spend the summers there. Pre-COVID. COVID changed a lot of what was happening in education. And generally, I would come back to the States, spend the summer, and then return to a different location or to the same location working with the Department of State. And that's where that side of it comes in. So I went to China originally in Zhengzhou to teach economics at a finance and economics university. Communist government paid for my plane ticket. I went and experienced some amazing things. Got there in, like I said, the middle of the night. Was taken to by a taxi with a guide that met me at the airport. And
there's always a guide.
Yep.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Her name was Grace, her English name. And she took me to a location about 45 minutes away that there was no cars. We showed up and there was just old brick building. And I was thinking, oh, my gosh.
I'm never going back.
What have I done?
The interrogation.
Yeah. So it turned out to be the back of an entry gate. And we went in, and it was an old university building. And my apartment was on the fourth floor. It was an old university dorm building that had two large rooms and a connecting hallway. And I had that for a year. But I remember this so succinctly because it was so different from what I was used to. In Redding, California, or parts of the Bay Area where I lived.
Mostly anywhere else, yeah.
Anywhere else.
Yeah.
And metal bars on the windows, metal door, and everything there is built for people. Because if you have carpet, it'll wear out quick. Just the traffic, 1.4 billion people.
Oh, you mean it's built for volume of people?
Volume. Small people. Yeah. So a lot of small people.
Oh, the shower head that hits you, right in the...
Well, and the shower head was in the kitchen.
Oh, okay.
Along with the toilet.
My bad to assume that there was an actual shower.
Yeah, and it was maybe 5 feet across. So it was a tiny little kitchen between the two rooms.
With a shower in it?
With a shower and a toilet.
So did you cook in the toilet or the shower?
No. I mean, it kind of doubled as several rooms.
Huh.
And it had a hand wash, that you see if you take your shower out of the holder.
Sure.
To wash things around and down. But it was my first experience to a foreign country like that. I've been to many different places in my past. Been to about 50 different countries. But it was my first time to China. Before and since, I've been to a lot of different countries. But
you're like, take me back to my tiny house, huh?
Yeah. So I'm thinking, wow, here I am in the middle of the night, bars on the windows, on the fourth floor, no elevator. China, if it's less than 7 stories, it doesn't have an elevator. Oh, that's generally the policy throughout China.
Better be in good shape.
Yeah.
Well, those 14 stairs at the new house, Bill?
Yeah, that's nothing.
I told you I like extreme sports.
Just living in China.
So there I am, and I have my Chinese translator and guide bringing me in and closes the door, gives me a key, and I can't get out. The lock won't work. And I'm thinking, boy, I hope there's not a fire.
Oh, yeah. Were you supposed to be able to get out? Was that just an actual accident?
I debated that in my mind.
Yeah,
many
I'd
times.
Be.
But that was very interesting.
That
was kind of my
way.
Introduction to communist China, and the next day I was missing my shoes for my luggage, and it's very hard to find size 12 shoes.
In China where everybody's 4 feet tall.
Oh, no kidding! They disappeared out of your luggage.
So it cost me $300.
I wouldn't think size 12 would be big in China.
Not today, but back 10 years ago, China has changed dramatically, which is something we can talk about as well. But at that time, it was very difficult. And you can imagine I didn't speak Mandarin. I finally got out of the room. The person told me how to open the door. The lock was difficult to work. Walked down the street taking pictures so I knew how to get back to where I was.
Yeah.
Found some shoes, $300.
Wow.
Yeah. Got railroaded on that. But
you had them bronzed and you have them mounted on your wall now?
Yeah. And I went to the university, and the university was only maybe 8 miles away. It took 2 hours to get there.
Oh.
And taught my first class in a college class with 150 students, 3 hours, 10 minutes, or it was a 5 minute break at the top of the hour. And they had to run out and run back to use the restroom or facilities. And you could hear, heard a pin drop, just complete silence for that entire 3 hours. Unlike it is in America, you know, where they're constantly getting bombarded.
So, all understood English then?
You know,
if they didn't, they were just really quiet.
There's different levels of English, and there's four different areas because you have listening, speaking, reading, and writing. There's productive and receptive skills.
Right.
So it's difficult when you're immersed into a community, and in China, English is compulsory in the third grade.
Oh.
They have to start learning English in the third grade. Unlike America, where, you know, if we have an, I like to say that some people are bilingual. They know two different languages. Some people are multilingual. They know more than two. And then there's people that know one language, and those are Americans.
And those are Americans, yeah.
So, and unfortunately, you know, we go there, all really good intentions. Many things happen when you're there that you're hoping will occur. But then there's a lot of things that are shocking and controversial that I found.
Oh, I bet. We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, let's start there because that sounds like a good spot to start. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
A couple guys in first class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles. Kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants. 30,000 feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who'd want to live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, busted his ass for you and me. You're caught a harvest moon in Kansas. They'd understand why I got made those flyover states. I bet that mile long.
Straight up, what did you hope to learn about here? If I was someone else, would this all fall apart? Strange, where were you when we started this game? I wish the real world would just stop hassling me.
I should quit hassling me too.
So no, when you got there,
we're here with Professor Dan Sloan. We had somebody wanted to know, who are they talking to? Sorry about that, Professor Dan Sloan, or Dr. Dan Sloan, or Professor Dr. Dan Sloan.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go.
Probably got a middle initial. We need to throw that in there.
W.
There you go. Full resume.
Boom.
Okay. So wait, the thing we have to find out is. I didn't want to interrupt your story before, although I want to do that. The Communist Party. How do you accidentally bump into the Communist Party and then accidentally wind up in China in a locked room teaching in front of a silent room?
Yeah. So almost immediately, I was only there for a week or two and had really high interest from the Communist Party and from the people at the university. Cause, you know,
but how'd you meet them here? Like, how'd they find you here?
Well, I was... because of the experience of not being able to communicate well in that first class, I began taking courses at University of Southern California, USC, another graduate degree. I have 3.5 graduate degrees. I'm working on a fourth and a doctorate in the Chinese currency. So that kind of gives you background
on
my...
That's tricky.
Yeah. It's financial economics in the renminbi and internationalization of their currency. So... part of what I was doing is learning how to teach as a master's of teaching with an emphasis in TESOL, which is teaching English to speakers of other languages, so that I could communicate better and learn how to teach pedagogical and andragogical, all these educational terms and curriculum design and all that, so that I could better communicate. That's when it came to the attention of both the Communist Party and to the American government. So my ability to communicate well, to teach and design curriculum well, and the fact that I'm an academic and not a diplomat provided the opportunity for me to do things they could not do. You know, I would get calls from the consulate general or embassy ambassador to go to parties, do things that they were not invited to go to.
Really?
Because they'd have to do a lot of legwork and establish things before.
Oh, yeah.
And they couldn't.
Because they were representatives.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was
easy. We can just get Dr. Dan on the guest list. And
so I ran around
push
China.
Him in there. Yeah. You have a suit?
So I began working with the American government, with the U.S. Department of State. And the Chinese government loved what I was doing as well. It kind of opened a lot of doors. Pretty soon I was teaching 1 to 2 days a week. And traveling the rest, going from province to province to province. I've probably been to almost every province in China.
That's a big place.
A big place. And I saw it during a time when there was a radical transformation.
What was the time period of this?
From 2011 to 2018.
Okay.
A little before that. But, you know, on and off, I was – and then I went to Laos after that, which is just south of China, and spent a year in Vientiane, Laos, with the U.S. Embassy in Vientiane. And my office was actually at the Lao Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So my students were the senior staff of the Lao government, 150 communists with a Putin on my screensaver and communist flags on the desk and green, lime green, you know, uniforms for everybody that was my colleagues there.
No kidding.
So I had a blessing that I was able to learn so much about a different form of government that I could come back and provide to the people that I work with and the students. You know, it's just awesome to have that. I love to learn. Obviously, I've got a lot of different degrees, but I also love to allow people to learn. That's why I'm here today.
Did you ever stumble onto things that you weren't supposed to teach or weren't supposed to?
Yeah,
all the time. Imagine. Yeah.
The proverbial red flag went up.
Yeah, old time out.
Well, you know, Tiananmen Square is one of those.
Yeah.
And what happens when you have a residency permit, you have a your regular passport, and at times I had a diplomatic passport, but normally I would get two passports. You know, you can do that if you show that you have need, and was able to get two. So that if one was taken and that regularly happened, that I would have another so I could get out of there and go somewhere else or do things differently. Wow. But many times when you're signing up for your residency permit in China, you take a test, an online test, and that test is really to make sure that you understand the rules. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's what you can do.
We don't care if you're going to be a good citizen, because we consider mm-hmm. good citizen somebody who mm-hmm. doesn't color outside the lines.
The do's and don'ts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So here's all the things you can't do.
Okay.
You
can't prophesize. Just going to ask.
Yeah. You can't go out and overtly use religion. You know, it's an atheist country.
Right.
People think, well, you know, they must be anti-religion or against the whatever particular type of religion or church, and it's really not the issue. Every tyrant is afraid of competition.
Sure.
And that's what they're really afraid of. So they don't want the people to have or become enamored with anything other than the
anything
Communist Party.
Than
yeah,
them.
The government must be the religion, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And then you can't have they don't have the right of assembly like we have here. You know, you can't encourage people to collectively gather or go out and picket or use some form of civil disobedience or anything like that. You just disappear.
Yeah.
And
we've seen that recently with several people that spoke out against the government or spoke out against something they weren't supposed to, and then we don't see them anymore.
Yeah. So Tiananmen Square is something that you don't talk about. You know, if it comes up, I've been to Tibet as well, and there's many, many different things. Again, the communists have moved in there. China's, you know, had a hold on them for many years, but it's a similar type of environment there.
Yeah, well, Tibet's always been kind of an outlier. They kind of done their own thing and stayed away from, or tried to stay away from the Chinese government, but
yeah,
not
you can't
too
anymore.
Successful.
Yeah, there's getting back to China and going to Tibet, if you want, but China is very strict on many of the rules. In fact, it's dissimilar to the United States, where you know what you can't do because the law tells you you can't do it. You know, like, here's the speed limit. You can't drive any faster than this. In China, it's the opposite. You can't do anything unless they tell you.
Oh.
So you're not limited by the government. You're allowed by the government.
But think about what that means.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you do. If you wake up in the morning, you've already violated the law. Because they'll just find something.
Yeah.
You did something you weren't supposed to because we didn't tell you you could.
What a weird way to live.
No, it's not. Well, it's a horrible way to live, but that's...
Okay, how hard was it? Well, you had a minder while you were there, but did they just spend the whole time saying, don't do that, Dan. Don't do that. Nope, not that either. Nope.
Yeah, got to be careful. And I've got lots and lots of examples of that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, do tell.
And in Guangzhou, China, I was there for a year. And was teaching at a university as well as doing the couple days a week teaching and then traveling around. They had a large number of journalism students. And this is very interesting, especially right now with what's going on in social media in America. So they have a lot of journalism students. And those journalism students would come up to me and say, we have a project that we'd like to use in writing a paper for your course. You know, each one of them had a different topic, a different project. And so, great, where'd they come from? Well, we're part of the Communist Party. Everybody has to join in order to get their tuition paid as part of their schooling here. And they assign us a project to go out and interview somebody at a factory or at an administrative building or something, and a hospital. So they each one had one, and I said, okay, well, tell me a little bit about it so that I will know how to use that in your coursework. Well, they assign us the factory. They tell us who we need to interview. They give us the questions, and then they give us the answers, and they give us the photographs.
Oh,
a real learning experience.
Yeah. So, what you see isn't really on social media and other things what you'd expect, you know, because it's obviously just contrived.
Yeah, it's totally and, government controlled. And it's
government
only
control.
Only what they want to hear.
Yeah, and then what happens is these same students were telling me, "Well, we're also required to go on social media." In China, you've got WeChat and RenRen, Youku, which is the same as YouTube, but YouTube's blocked. You got Baidu instead of Google. You just have there's no Twitter. If you use a VPN, you can get WhatsApp and some other things. But a lot of it's blocked. Most Western social media is blocked. So what ends up happening is on the big universities where you have a journalism school, they'll unblock some of those social media, American or Western social media, which means Facebook's unblocked, Instagram, Twitter, WhatsApp, all those are unblocked, but only within that university.
Well, that's got to open up all kinds of problems for them, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't, because they require those 20,000 university students that are in journalism school to go on, create fake accounts, and produce product that is favorable to the Chinese propaganda, the Communist Party.
Go ahead and say what you want as long as it's about us and it's good.
And so here we are blocking our president and blocking our people from having access, you know, in fake news and all that stuff, when in reality, we've allowed the Communist Party to just drown what we're doing with false information
right.
in bank accounts. And it's just astounding
you
know, that happens. But that's the reality. I've been there. I've lived that. So it's amazing.
I had no idea.
It's got to be really creepy to look at what's going on here with that as a backdrop.
It is, and I teach social media marketing as one of the courses out at Simpson University to undergraduates, and we review things like what's happening with Elon Musk and Twitter. I'm taking it private, and we've got Kanye West with Parler taking it private. We've got President Trump and Truth Social taking it private, and all these things lead to, you know, investigating what that means, you know, what kind of free speech rights will be elevated or eliminated, and how that all works out in the securities exchange or the FCC, not just security, FCC,
sure.
How they might regulate things. Because right now they're regulated as a, as almost like a utility.
Right.
And like you guys. And they have to be careful what's put on their social network, or they might regulate them. And so they're trying to self-regulate. And what that looks like here as opposed to what it looks like in China.
So if you've never been outside of China, your view of the world is as limited as we think it is.
It is very limited because there are algorithms and AI, artificial intelligence. I've had WeChat, which is the equivalent of a Twitter account here, similar to it, except WeChat does many other things, and that's part of the control. You can do everything on it. So it's so convenient. That's what they tell me. Yeah, they know
so
everything about you.
Alarm bells are going off.
Yeah. Oh, no. It was so convenient.
Super.
Yeah. So it does everything, but
with
WeChat, what happens, I speak with people almost regularly every day that are in Beijing, people that are have faith. They want to talk to me about Christianity and other things. But we have to kind of do things differently because when they do communicate, the algorithms will look for – they'll search for keywords and key phrases. Mm-hmm. So when you're having a conversation, the other bubble doesn't show up sometimes. Your bubble going that way is deleted. Their bubble coming your way is deleted.
Oh.
So you have really awkward conversations because you don't know entirely what was said.
What they're really hearing and what they're really saying.
Yeah.
So do you come up with – like substitute words for things?
Yeah. And again, there's language barrier issues, cultural issues. I'm astute enough because of living there that I can pretty much know what they mean.
Sure.
But if you didn't, you probably wouldn't be able to guess what are they talking about. But anyway, it does lead to that kind of environment where you're only getting part of the communication and you have to kind of fill in the blanks or go with some words that are understandable between the parties.
So when they're, you know, regulating or just doing all this stuff with Facebook and all of our different media to keep everyone, you know, from, I don't know, I guess reading something that might make them sad or unhappy or angry or whatever, how reminiscent is that of, like, you've seen the end point of that.
There's all kinds of awkward I'm probably diabolical as well as uncivil issues that come up. If you remember Sandy Hook, the elementary school, I believe there were 20 or 20 some odd children that were shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were six other adults that were also killed on that horrible, horrible situation. That was in December, I think, of 2012. 4 days later, in Zhengzhou, where I was living, I told you about iPhone City, there were 20 children that were murdered and one adult with a knife. But we didn't hear about that in America. It happened at the same time, within days of each other. So to the outside world, they control the media very, very closely. You can find it today on the internet because now it's long enough ago and people have gotten outside of China and posted stories about it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time I was thinking, wow, the people in America don't even realize the same, they're just people, and you know, people have mental illness and all kinds of, you know, strange oddities and maladies.
But they make it look like it's only here.
So what?
And China's not big on allowing things to get out that make China look bad. I mean, that's right. Obviously the name of the game.
Tiananmen Square was a really good example early on that they held back what really happened there.
Right.
And you know, over here, all we saw was somebody standing in front of a tank. Nobody really got killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of our people who have come here from China to study and have stayed said that as kids, they were told that the students attacked the military and the military was just defending itself.
Yeah.
And it took
– with a tank.
Like the one gal, it took her like 10 years before she was brave enough to go on – even though she lived here, until she was brave enough to go look it up and then found out what really happened and was like, okay, I think my whole life's been a lie. I mean, that's a big one. That's a really big one, and it was just absolutely somehow they managed to keep everybody from I'm curious, when we come back, we have to take a quick break again, but when we come back, I want to know, like, what's the underground communication like? Are people just scared out of doing that? Or is that a common thing? Because I would think that would make the underground a big thing. Okay, because I'm already planning. I'm going in the underground, apparently, because I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I'm not living like this.
You won't last long.
I don't even live in China, and I want to be in the underground. So we're here with Professor Dan Sloan. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
No more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore. No more self-reliance.
Well, I guess you could stay in your house, unless you live in China. Then they're spying on you in your house, even under the covers,
the
in the middle
on
of the
really
night.
Really loud when you're talking to somebody.
Yeah, do they do that? In the spy movies where they turn the radio on or go in the bathroom and run the water?
What happened with me? I had explained my initial experience, but after that, I was traveling about 200,000 miles a year. Flying all over the Chinese country, as well as back to the United States, DC, and all over Asia and the world. But when I moved from working independently to working with the Department of State, I was told that I had to leave or had to live in a setting that was different from what I was used to. Not really nice hotel room in various locations. And of course, when I'm traveling, they're very nice. In fact, it depend on who wanted me to come to their location. The Chinese would always try to outdo the American government. So they would pick me up at the airport, not take me to the American hotel. Of course, they're for obvious reasons, but to take me to this really nice hotel.
With the high surveillance.
Yeah, with the high surveillance.
The super high surveillance.
It's actually an echo in the room when you spoke.
Well, they have pillows now that know when you're not asleep anymore. So, yeah. You know, I'm sure that's probably where they came from.
I lived in a hotel room generally either on or near the campus, very nice rooms. And of course, along with a hotel room comes the cleaning of your room every day. Mm-hmm. And my room would get cleaned. I would wait till I went out or I would go out to the store to get a few items down the street, you know, just across the street or something. And I'd be gone for 5 minutes, come back, my room's clean.
It was magic.
It was
wow.
Magic. Yeah, 5 minutes.
And they weren't watching you or anything.
No.
Wow.
So you walked by, you walked in past the lobby and the clerk that's watching you. You have all of the cameras outside and inside the lobby and hallways. I found out that my communist leader counterpart had, in one place, at least I know of it there, had rented an apartment across the street. So they were watching me from across the street. We go into your room, and we found a listening device behind pictures. Your expectation of privacy is zero.
So you mostly just shower with all your clothes on?
Yeah, I mean, in some cities around China, women are encouraged not to to walk around their hotel in the nude because you don't want to have the pictures on the internet. It's to that extreme. And I've walked around the university at night, going from one location to the next. And I always felt very, very safe in China in terms of my personal safety. I couldn't have done what I did. And then I have a strong faith. And that faith has provided me with an opportunity to feel like I have somebody watching and guiding me. And I wouldn't have been there if it weren't for that. And most people have a very difficult time surviving under a really hardcore environment. I'd stand out in China, but I was walking at night and between two buildings, and Behind the barred windows was a group of probably 20 people, students. They were looking at screens and rolling their little mouse around. And what it was is they were scrolling through the video of all the cameras and looking at every single one of them to kind of catch what people were doing. But it's just a really eerie feeling.
Was that their job or?
Yeah, well, that was part of their tuition reimbursement because they had to work, and that was part of what they were doing.
They were part of the spy network.
Yeah, so they do that. And then, you know, don't kill me here, but I work for work with our government. And
we probably won't kill you for that.
the presidents change. And one of the experiences I had was in across from Tiananmen Square is a museum, the People's Museum, which there's a lot of events and the Summer Palace and all that stuff's right there. It's really interesting to see all the ancient history and everything. But I was there with during a high economic summit with John Kerry and Jacob Lew. Gave a presentation there. And observed things, and we had to take apart our badges that we had in order to make sure there's no listening devices in those. So the experiences you get into there are knowing, you know, it's like a lot of corporate CEOs, corporate executives, when they go to China, they'll buy a brand new computer with nothing on it, put only what they need, and then throw it away because you've got viruses in everything.
That's what they tell like congressional staff when they go over there. If they have to go over there for some reason, you take a burner phone with nothing in it, obviously, and you leave it at the airport.
Yeah. So everything is just taken as, and I would normally carry three laptops with me, and I had to do that because invariably at least one or two would break down from all the viruses. So wherever I was going to, if I didn't have a couple computers to fall back on, I would not have anything.
Wow.
Because it's such a big problem to where they're gaining access and disrupting what you're doing.
Wow. You would think that, I mean, most of the time you think, well, they can't be spying on everybody. Who's got that kind of time?
Oh, they do.
But they've got that kind of time.
Well, they got that number of people.
Well, I would imagine, especially foreigners, they're probably watched every instant.
An interesting aspect of that is a lot of people think, well, I'll just get a VPN, virtual private network. And a lot of security people talk about that. But and there's a lot of things we could discuss in terms of economies and the way that things are done different in China. Being communist, all the factors of production are owned by the communist government. Whether they're perceived as being owned by Jack Ma or Alibaba or whoever or Elon Musk, you don't own anything. If Elon is lucky to get out of the country and get on the plane with a suitcase, I consider that lucky. You know,
so all the iPhone factories over there, I mean, they're probably all preloaded with Chinese software or some kind of surveillance software. You think
they are preloaded? But the VPNs, what I was thinking about is because of the way that the communist government holds dear access to 1.4 billion people, which is 21% of the world's population. They have this, and people don't think about that. We're only about four and a quarter percent of the world's population, America. And we have such a massive influence over politics, economics, military, culture. You know, we just...
Hence the need to control us and shut us up.
The U.S. dollar, you know, and it's the trade settlement and reserve currency of the world. And because of that, China has been very critical about allowing inward foreign direct investment into their country. So generally, if you're going to do that, you set up a joint venture. Then you get a Chinese partner, which is required most of the time. They want to own 51%, so they have a controlling interest. You have to give them that, okay? And then if you're a software company, that means they have access.
Oh, yeah.
So your VPN, you're self-identified as somebody who's trying to hide something. and you're paying them, you know, $8 a month for them to spy on you. So you're identifying, over here, look over here. I'm going to pay you.
I would like my own group of people to look at my stuff. Oh. Yeah.
So there's all kinds of interesting problems that happen because of that. And we just invite it. We're willfully gullible when we go there thinking this time it'll be different. And I've seen that happen all too often. Generally, what will happen is the foreign country will go in. I know of an Italian brake manufacturer for Indy cars, really high end. They started producing their brakes in China. They went in under this kind of an ordeal or relationship. And what happens is, just like with Elon, they'll start building a copy of the factory next mm-hmm. door down the street. And then you train all of the people. They get all of your infrastructure, your IP, intellectual property. And then about 3 or 4 or 5 years into the venture, they say, you know what? You guys are doing so great. Why don't we sell you our part, the 51%? And the companies come out and do it. They'll give them $1 billion or $2 billion. And then 6 months later, because they're communist, they can tell their people, if you come to work with an iPhone, you're fired. So suddenly the sales domestically just drop off to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens. And generally, when they get to that point, and hasn't happened yet with iPhones, it hasn't happened yet with Starbucks or Tesla, but it's happened repeated. Google's not there anymore. Netflix isn't there. There's both sides of that are against putting their intellectual property in China because it can be ripped off so easily. So their ethical conduct and legal conduct has a completely different view than what it does from our Western views. Yeah. So,
but I would imagine any of the American companies that go over there and do business are fully aware of that before they set foot in country. They're aware that that's going to happen, aren't they?
And Caterpillar went in through Hong Kong mm-hmm. and invested about $600 million through a Hong Kong joint venture. It only lasted for a little while. They went in to do an audit, and that's another issue. but they went in to do a physical audit and found none of the equipment there. They lost all of their investment.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's just been – and that's what happened to that auto brake producer is they bought back their original 51% that they had given to the Chinese company or partner in order to do business. And then soon all of their business dried up because they just took advantage of it.
Sure.
Yeah. And then you look at what happens with Amazon, another example. In 2011 – when I arrived there, I got my Amazon.cn account. I still have it, Amazon China. And they had 15% of the e-commerce market. Okay, really, I mean, not 1.4 billion people. That's a lot of
business. That's a lot of business.
That's a lot of business.
What?
But by 2019, they had less than 1% and had to leave. They exited the Chinese market.
Because they copied their system. And
Alibaba.
And ripped it all off.
JD.com. Yeah. A whole bunch of – and what happens, I was blessed with having an opportunity to be there and experience how they did it, because it was done in typical Chinese style, in that they copied everything that Amazon did. And Amazon came in and built out all the infrastructure, all the warehousing and the delivery system, accounting systems, logistics, and supply chain, all of that, built it all out. Billions and billions of dollars. They copied all that. And then when I ordered something, I lived on the 11th floor, for example, in Wuhan, I would order something, and originally they would deliver it right to the apartment. They'd bring it up the elevator, knock on your door, here's your package, here's what you ordered.
That's from Amazon.
Yeah, and 6-8 months later.
It was out in the street.
It was out in the street. You have to go down.
Oh, I was kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. It was out in the street. So you go down, there's this big lawn out there, and there's just packages everywhere.
They just whipped it out of the van and drove off, huh?
Well, and then you had to sign for it. But then 6 or 8 months after that, you had to go down the street 2 or 3 miles. Go to a place to get it. And then after that was maybe 5-10 miles away.
Go make it yourself.
Well, then you just stop ordering through Amazon.
Go sell your own clothes.
Yeah.
You had to order through Alibaba or one of the others, JD, a domestic. See what I'm saying?
Oh, so they broke Amazon. This wasn't when it was replaced. This was as they were breaking it down.
Slowly.
And replacing it out.
Yeah. Through non-tariff barriers, they were slowly changing the business for Amazon.
1 minute.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
That's how they do it. That's how they roll.
Because there's not a lot of innovation, but there's just an incredible skill at
they're incredibly
replicating.
Brilliant people, and they are very innovative. That's just a misnomer. But in a communist society, if you share your idea, you shared it with 1.4 billion people.
Right.
So you write a book or you have a patent, it's gone.
It's gone immediately.
You never reinvent the wheel.
So there's very brilliant people. They want to come here.
They are the wheel.
They want to come here.
So that they can
have
ideas.
Have access to intellectual property rights and a strong rule of law.
Wow.
And a judicial system.
And people here think, communism, if we just do it a different way, it'll be great.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not good. Something yeah. weird going
well,
on.
Well, we always hear
headphone.
About their, you know, stealing intellectual property. I don't think most people realize the scale that that goes on.
God.
Well, they have probably the largest patent office in the world.
Of course they do.
Everything's made there. If you have an idea and innovation here, you've got to have it made there.
We'll be right back. Yeah. Our guest is Dr. Dan Sloan. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And I don't need to see anymore to know that I can read your mind.
Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Go up and see them. Thanksgiving is just around the corner, and you should probably put a new tractor
Under your turkey,
yeah. Yeah, I think that would
Don't try to go buy any celery or cranberries, though, because those are in short supply.
Short supply, that's right.
Store had zero yesterday.
Yeah.
No celery, no cranberries. Just odd.
Yeah. Well.
I don't know why we had a run on celery, but.
Shortage. I mean, you have to have shortages.
Exactly. Otherwise, yeah. It's not fun.
That's right. So you can go up and see them at 3119 Twinview Boulevard or give them a call at 226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And I figured out the obvious free advertising of the week.
Oh.
Duh. It should be Simpson University.
Hey, there you go.
Duh. What was I thinking?
Perfect.
So you do the free advertising of the week.
Well, we have some amazing programs. And a lot of stuff we're doing lately is involving STEM-related, which is science, technology, engineering, math. But we have, obviously, obvious to us that are local, a nursing program that is just number one in the state. Amazing people. We're just so blessed to have the faculty that we have. Incredible people for this community. They just love the area and live here. And then the students that we bring in, a majority of them come from this region. So a lot of them from the Valley. Mm-hmm. They're in the, La Malfa area, the agriculture and farming right. and
district
all the way.
District one, congressional yeah, district yeah, one. Yeah.
Oh, but all the way down to Bakersfield and then we have some international students, but, the business program I teach in the undergrad, in, CIS, computer information systems, business, and, the people that are in the, masters of organizational leadership. I'm part of, leadership reading as well. And we're boosting what is happening out there in our local leadership, like people like you, Aaron, and others that are out there in the community trying to make a
big
difference.
Well, you can spot the Simpson kids, mm-hmm. you know, when you go to restaurants and different things, and you'll have somebody who's just really clean cut, super mm-hmm. nice, really on task, you know, yeah. the kind of kids you want to have working in your business, and never fails through the course of conversation, you know, oh, I'm a student over at Simpson's. Like, of course you are.
Yeah. And then I'll go into a room full of people that are there that are involved in the community, and invariably, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50% of them are alumni. And there's 4,000 alumni of the adult degree completion program, which is where when people can go back later in life, complete their bachelor's degree. So we have a wide range of courses in the people that usually are in them rise to the top. They're
it's a great campus too. It's not, you know, it's not difficult to navigate. It's not crowded. And we live really near there. And you would think like, oh, you live by university. What a drag.
Yeah.
No, it's awesome. It's awesome. It's a very, very nice place. So if you have kids, nieces, nephews, Simpson University in beautiful Redding, California, it's kind of not downtown either, which is nice. You know, you don't have the parking problems. You don't have the crime problems. You're in a great part yeah. of town over on the east side.
Beautiful.
There you go. That was a good free advertisement of the week.
Thank you.
Professor Dan Sloan. So he is our captive again this hour. So we can learn more
about Communist China.
Our captive from Communist China, we got him in the studio.
One thing we didn't really talk about, if I went to China, because I just That's why I was out of the room. Oh, I was booking a flight to China. I want to get my seats early.
They already told me because they were watching you.
So when I get over there and I want to rent a car and tour the country, how's that work?
Probably not.
That's a big no.
A good idea.
I would think so.
Yeah.
That's how Bill winds up being missing.
Yeah. Missing.
Missing. Yeah, and you might attract somebody to run into you because you're a foreigner.
Literally.
Yeah. Because then there'd be some liability on your part.
Wow.
And some fear that, you know, you might be held captive to having to pay, you know,
by
extorted.
The
well, by the person or by the government. Normally, what happens when somebody's in an automobile accident, they just stop the car right where it's at. Even if the traffic, you know, is snarled for hours, you just stop right where you're at. They send out the local insurance company. It's all owned by the government. But the insurance company will come out, write up a report, decide who's guilty on the spot, and then ask you to go get money out of your ATM and come pay the person.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. So
one and done, huh?
Yeah. And so decisions are made very, very quickly. And they do that because, you know, socialism and communism encourage cheating. You know, it's a paternalistic type of government, and people expect government to do things for them, and in accordance with that, they're supposed to obey certain rules. And of course, everybody's getting the minimum out of the government, and then they're going to be the one that cheats and gets away with it. Mm-hmm. They're the smart person, so everybody continues to cheat.
Wow.
So it's endemic within society, and so you can't rid yourself of it. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there's a lot of these things are done that way purposely because they know their people are going to cheat.
Wow.
That's funny. I've heard that same story. I did business with a company out of the Dakotas that sold equipment in Russia. Mm. And they said they have to be very, very careful when they're dealing with Russians because over there, if they cheat you or they get your equipment and don't pay for it, they don't look at that as cheating. They look at that as just they're better business people.
Advantage Russia.
Advantage Russia. And they said you have to be very, very careful because that's the first thing on their mind is to take advantage of you.
Yeah. Well, I told you I was there with Kerry and Lou, John Kerry and Jacob Lou, in a high-level economic and exchange summit. And We were back in a back room, and the person sitting next to me was a university. It was from what's the dance school back in New York? It slipped my mind.
Oh,
the what?
Juilliard.
Juilliard. The president of Juilliard was sitting next to me, and so I gave a presentation, and he gave his presentation, and then we went around with the economic stuff. And generally, what happens, and this is my perception of what happens in China, when we come there with our government. Generally, it's already planned in advance. There's an agenda. There's documents that have already been printed up, an agreement that's supposed to have already been made. We bring it in under our law, under American law. We created the document in English. We cited the types of law as well as the consequences of not obeying that law. And we present it in front of them, and they're great. Did you bring the money? Number one.
Yeah.
And we'll sign it, but and you're going to sign it. We have no intention of ever obeying it. You do, and we're going to hold you to it because it's under your law in your language.
So you're bound by your law. We're not.
We're not. We have no intention, and we do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just that understanding that that's the way it's going to work. And unfortunately, we just keep repeating the same mistake. And in reality – When you're Chinese and you're looking across the pond, and a lot of Chinese come to America, and I've told you off the air that I just absolutely love the Chinese people. The people themselves are people. They want to worship. They want to have freedom. They want all the various types of things they can do with freedom, including freedom of speech and opportunity and all the things we take for granted. Kind of lost my train of thought there, but the way that they look at what we do here in America is how they're going to treat us. So when we don't obey our own laws, why would they?
Yeah.
When we've got 5 million people coming across the southern border.
Yeah. Right.
When we've got people going into Walgreens or Rite Aid or name the store and walking out and there's no consequences for their illegal behavior. You know, just drugs, alcohol, all the things that happen in our society, and we're not in charge of what we're doing. And they're just looking at that saying, you know, if you're not going to obey your own laws, why would we? And that's my own personal opinion as to what's really happening
well,
there.
That's the message.
But it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Because, honestly, we have a lot of people in this country that are kind of thinking, why am I working so hard? You know, I mean, does that make me dumb?
I have students at Pepperdine at the law school. And where I work down there is in a think tank. It's the Strauss Institute for Arbitration and Mediation, for Dispute Resolution, ADR. Alternative dispute resolution. And if you think about what that really is, most Americans are thinking mediation. Okay. It's an easy one to think about. So mediation means that you get in a room, the two parties or however many parties there are, you have a mediator, multiple mediators, you talk about the issues, you try to resolve the conflict without going to court, which means you've just sidestepped the legal system. Okay. So when you have a lot of international students that come in, and a lot of them are judges. My students are at Pepperdine. Some of them from China. They're coming in order to find ways to go around American law, not a way to resolve the dispute or the conflict because they don't want to go to court.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, what will happen in China, what I was just talking about, if you sign a contract in China with a Chinese company that's ultimately owned by the Chinese communist government, it'll go in front of a court before they ever step foot on a foreign land. Like if you have an agreement, Alibaba and Walmart or something, between these two companies, they'll have an arbitration agreement in the contract that sidesteps the American government. They decide on the language, on the law. It might be Dutch law if it has to do with shipping or something like that. So they'll have another venue for the legal system. But before they ever leave China, they'll go to a Chinese court and have it deemed illegal under Chinese law. But they won't tell the other side.
No.
So then they go to mediation or arbitration, most likely. When they go to arbitration, they'll let the arbitral court and tribunal go through and decide who wins and loses. If they win, woo, yeah, we benefited from the legal system. If they lose, then they pull out the legal document from the Chinese court and say, it was illegal, so we can't pay. So what are you going to do to me?
Right.
How many aircraft carriers are you going to send to collect?
Exactly.
So,
kind of game over.
And then we do it again. We do it again.
And then we do it all
over. And we walk right back in.
So, you know, it's our fault, in my opinion, for allowing it to happen. It's what I call willful gullibility. We go into it knowing this. A lot of it is because of the American currency, the U.S. dollar being the preeminent. It's part of my doctoral dissertation is that it's the trade settlement and reserve currency of the world. And that's what everybody uses in order to settle trade. And unfortunately, what that's done for us since World War II, since Bretton Woods, it was based on the dollar or the an ounce of gold. The dollar was based on $35 an ounce for gold.
Right.
In 1965, Charles de Gaulle, the president of France, sent a fleet over and picked up all the gold that they had exchanged their currency for.
Because we were holding.
And he was saying, well, you guys are going to go bankrupt. You can't possibly go to war in, you know, Vietnam and Korea and go to the moon and all of the social issues and all the stuff that was happening at that time. And then within 6 years, 1971, we went off the gold standard. He was right. By 73, we went on to the petrodollar, had all kinds of problems. 2001, 15 of the 19 terrorists for 9/11 were Saudis, and we pivoted on December 11th of 2001. We allowed China into the World Trade Organization. And what we did at that time was export pollution, and we exported jobs, and we imported deflation. So back in the Jimmy Carter era, you know, right when Reagan came in, we had really high inflation, which we haven't seen until this year.
Until now.
Yeah. Until now. 40 years worth of declining interest rates. It was at 15.86% in 1980, June of 1981. That was the 10-year treasury yield. So it was way up there. You buy a house, it was like buying it on a credit card. And if you look at it, it was almost a linear equation, a straight line all the way down to zero this year. Had nowhere to go but up. So that's why I had my dissertation, because it appeared obvious to me that there's no way we could sustain the type of spending that we have. And there's a guy named Minsky. By the way, during the Obama years, we had Jeffrey Immelt, who was in charge of the President's Council on Jobs and Innovation or something like that. And when China was allowed in 2001 into the World Trade Organization, GE was worth $500 billion, or was worth more than that. It lost It was worth $600 billion. It lost $500 billion between then and today. So it lost $500 billion in market capitalization. And where all that went was to China.
China.
Yeah. So I like to speak to my students about this and about others. When you go down to Walmart, and I'm only picking on – I'm not trying to pick on them, but this is the way it is. When you go into Walmart, look up on the ceiling by the registers, and you'll see American flags. They're hanging all the way along there. And then consider what percentage of the goods in that store are made in China.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So in my view, and I know this would never happen, but if we made a rule or a law that said you had to fly the flag of the country that had the most content in your store, what would that look like?
That would save us all a ton of time.
No, but what would that look like at Target, Costco?
Oh, yeah.
Every store.
Oh, yeah. You can't hardly buy anything anymore that's not made in China. Yeah. I mean, if you say, I'm only buying American-made, you're going to do a lot of shopping because it's hard to find stuff that's
better
made
be a
in
researcher.
America.
And then put an ATM, a Chinese ATM, at their checkout. Okay? Because I think it would remind people what's really happening here.
Where the money's really going.
Where it's really going. And we unfortunately, as individuals, have been seduced by low-cost consumer goods, a higher standard of living. Like I said, we imported deflation, but at the same time, we exported jobs and we exported the pollution. The American people think that they've got the cleanest economy in the world, which, you know, if you look at where the pollution is, we don't, because we are the ones that are causing the pollution there.
In the places that don't have
to. We're buying the products that are creating the pollution.
But if it were made here, I mean, we're pretty innovative, and our companies would, well, they'd have to care about it, but they would care about it. And we aren't really gross polluters, by and large, that isn't what you hear.
Well, that
isn't what people are told.
Yeah. That's where the dollar comes into effect. And there's a guy named Minsky back in the 1940s, 50s, and I think he died in about 1980 or 90s. That's what he had postulated, was that because of the dollar and our ability to print at will, that we could continue to print money, make all kinds of mistakes. And when those mistakes ended up poorly, we would just print our way out. Mm-hmm. And that his postulation was that it would occur at larger increments. So there's iterations. It would go back around. We would have a growth cycle, a speculation, all these crazy speculative environments like we have crypto and all this stuff. Then a collapse, spend our way out of it, print our way out of it. And then we'd have even a bigger problem. You know, like today we've got $31 trillion worth of debt. But on top of that, we've got Social Security of $22 trillion. And we've got Medicare of another $35 trillion and unfunded liabilities of another $175 trillion. So we've got a quarter of a quadrillion dollars worth of debt. Now, trillion was not in people's vernacular.
Mm-mm. And now it's 20 like we just throw that down.
Just don't even blink an eye. So quadrillion is the next one that's coming.
Oh, my God. We have to take a quick break. I wish I had a song about quadrillion, but I don't.
Mm-mm.
Makes me want to change that second song, Liam. I got another idea for you. But anyway, we're speaking with Dr. Dan Sloan. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
But I don't want some pretty face to tell me pretty lies. All I want is someone to be.
Hardly ever heard. the gold in California is in a bank in the middle of Beverly Hills in somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you've played before. California's a brand new game.
So, Professor Sloan, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I love it. California.
Yeah, like, highly unlikely, but it isn't a bank in someone else's name.
Yeah.
It just isn't gold, and, well, quadrillion is a real number.
Yeah.
Remember we used to say things like that and we were joking?
Uh-huh.
Like a gazillion dollars. Is a gazillion in the offing?
A gazillion? Probably.
working our way toward gazillions being real?
Yeah.
God. Okay, so what have we left out?
Well, there's...
Besides everything.
Everything. So there's just all kinds of amazing things that are happening out there. It's not all negative. You know, we tend to look at things that are different and discuss those, and sometimes it makes it look like, you know, everything's horrible. But I believe that if you have faith and you keep in mind that there's always somebody there to turn to talk to, and you're the people around you. And you guys had asked me earlier about family and what it was like and what's important to the Chinese people. They'll wear an American flag, a British flag. They love Australia, just, you know, the Western society and freedom.
You said their clothes are littered with flags, mm-hmm. and the Chinese government doesn't like it, but there are too many of them.
No, it's a lot of it's produced there, which is part of it.
Yeah.
So it's hard to strip that away. And then they love the influence. It's amazing is the students, it's compulsory to have English in the third grade. So they know English very well. Many of them are multilingual, meaning that they'll learn how to speak French and be fluent in French, German, Spanish, whatever, as well as English, just have a completely different educational system. I get to the students here in a minute, but just a real quick story about how their educational system is different from ours and why maybe people have a misunderstanding of what's going on when we have students from China come here and they appear to be brilliant. I've been there where in certain high schools, in Zhengzhou, I told you about it, how long it took me to get to work, 2 hours going 8 miles. Well, I had two apartments, and that ended up being the case because I ended up working for two different entities, had like 2.5 jobs. I've always been an overachiever, unfortunately, working too much. But and the other apartment was in the middle of a high school. And the students would get up at 6 o'clock. There was a bugle. Burr, 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 and they would get up. And they would do calisthenics, 3,000 students. E-R, Sun Tzu, E-R, Sun Tzu.
Wow.
Doing exercises.
Yeah.
Out there in the courtyard. All of them lived on campus, 100%.
Of the high school?
Of the high school.
Okay.
In my apartment was on the second floor of a two-story building. It was a house, basically. And it had a great veranda. Beautiful. I had a barbecue and patio furniture and all this stuff. And I thought, man, when I moved in there, this is going to be awesome. You know, just lay out there. Well, you know, and you could lay your meat out on the barbecue and get a chemical burn. from all of the smog. So laying out wasn't a good idea. You get just black. Oh, you just have all the soot all over you. So that didn't work out too well. But in the morning, I'd hear the students.
But it was a fun veranda to look at from the inside.
Yeah. So I'd see all the students out there. And then by 6:30, they'd be in the showers. By 7 o'clock, they would have already eaten something really quick and been in their seat. They're in their physics course first thing in the morning, 7 o'clock. They go to school all day long until 10 o'clock at night. And that's 5 days a week. So Monday through Friday, they went from 7 until 10 at night.
7 to 10.
On Saturday, they went from 7 until noon. Right. And then on Sunday, they went from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock. 6 o'clock p.m. to 10 o'clock p.m. During that 30 hours in between, their parents, one of them generally mother, would live across the street and take them to tutoring. So, and it was brutal. Something I highly do not recommend.
No, gosh, you'd get burned out.
Oh, yeah. It was horrible.
Yeah.
But, that's why they're doing, like I said, AP, CGIE, you know, all of the different IB, which is all of the foreign Cambridge and Oxford and all of the various programs that are prepping them to come to the United States or to a foreign university for those that are going that direction.
Mm.
So it's an amazing difference. They have a Weikao, Gaokao, Zhongkao, which are different tests that they take in order for entry into the next grade. So from middle school to high school, and it's actually from grammar school to middle school to high school into college or any vocational training. So June 7th, 8th, and sometimes the 9th in most provinces, they'll have a exit exam. And when, especially when they had one child, up until recently, they had the one child policy.
Mm-hmm.
They would take that exam and the whole life of that child was consumed with preparing for that exam. Because that was the opportunity for the family to have a future and to have an income.
Now, what happens to the kids that don't do well on the exams, the underachievers? So, it's got to be so.
Well, and what's interesting about that is in America, if you're caught cheating, most likely you'll be, some kind of penalty, maybe even to the point of expulsion from university. And I've seen where you have 1,200 parents out there tearing the fence down because they won't let them cheat. You know, it's the opposite.
What?
Wait. That's the culture.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Everybody else is cheating and you're not letting my child. And they'll have on the radio the day of the Gaokao, they have masseuse parlors out there where the children can come out and get a massage, get prepared for the next exam.
Wow. It's like the Olympics.
They'll shut down everything and the police will pick up children on the way to school and take them to school if they're falling behind to get there on time. They shut the factories down, so there's less noise. On the radio, like here, they'll have during the exam, they'll have people that call in and try to win prizes if they have the question and the answer, and then they announce them. So you know when you go.
No way.
It's a crazy environment.
You're like, I'm not at home anymore.
Yeah.
Like. Wow.
It's a really different environment than we're used to here. And the competitiveness is massive. They'll go through and paint every wall, take every poster, everything down because they don't want people to have the opportunity to cheat. Metal detectors, checking for the wire in young ladies' bras to make sure there's no listening devices in there.
To communicate.
And it's a surreal environment that they take at a very high level. Now, juxtapose that to what's happening to our educational system here. And, returning here, they have 1.4 billion people. So they self-select through various means to get a very high level of student. And, their rigor is very high,
mm-hmm.
but then there's a lot of cheating that goes on. So what will generally happen in my expertise, I told you a lot of it's in TESOL, so I know how to teach people and communicate with them very well. But then I have a master's of science and finance, an MBA, economics from Harvard, some other degrees that helped me get real specific in stuff. So a lot of the job that I was doing in certain areas was to check the authenticity so that the student had to do two things in China. They had to cheat really good in order to get a really high score. Because if they got a 99% on natural ability and everybody else got 100%, they couldn't leave. So you had to cheat. And I read.
Now you say they couldn't, they had to take it all over again?
No, they have to cheat because everybody else that's cheating will get a higher score.
Right.
Officially. And then they wouldn't be left in the dirt.
Right.
Because they
so what happens to those kids that don't do well?
Well, what ends up happening is the ones that do come here, if they cheat, they also have to be an overperformer. Because they come here, it costs $150,000-$200,000 to get an apartment, tuition,
sure.
Especially if you're living in a high-cost place where UCLA or USC or Pepperdine or any of those, very high cost. Same thing with Reading. You got to pay a lot. Then they come here and they fail if they have been underprepared but cheated in order to get a high score.
Right.
So they have to do both. But the students that fall behind, what generally will happen, they have – a different system there. Some are put into vocational schools, vocational training because of the score they achieve in order to determine what they're going to do for the rest of their life. And the same thing goes true with the universities. And they've got a high, low, and middle. So the university for law schools, because I deal a lot with law students, if unlike in America, where you become a lawyer, you may be in pro bono work at first, and then you work your way into doing stuff for the DA, public defendants, and stuff like that, and then work your way into private practice, and then eventually become a judge. In China, they can graduate from university and be a judge immediately. So they don't have to go through that whole system. But that means they're a really high level. So they go to that university, and then within that range of they're preparing to become a judge, there's the rank in those as well. So then that's all that is selected as they take those exams. That's why it's so incredibly important. And when they had the one child policy, the way that they mandated it was that, you know, in order to prevent people from having more than one child, because it's communist, you work for the government. So if you had another child, you lost your job. Then you have to, more mouths to feed and no job. Mm-hmm. So it was extremely important.
So do you find that the Chinese students over here, you know, in spite of the cheating and everything that goes on, do they do better over here than, say, the American students? Or are they pretty much on the same level?
It depends. You know, they've been prepped for culture, language. I had students in high school that took the SAT, SAT-2 type exams and AP and all that. Some of them that were taking history and got a perfect 800. You know, they know, go to the mall. I like to tell people, go to the mall and you can ask them a couple things. One of them is, what are the rules of grammar? And they'll have no clue. the Americans won't. But if you ask a Chinese person, they'll know all the rules. Okay. Cause that's what they're rules based.
Right.
So they study this stuff really, really well. And if they want to be, like we have, our pilots that are here from China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And they can probably tell you about that, the people that are, run the flight school out there. But they come here, and generally they're already hired by a Chinese airline as part of their agreement to come here to learn how to fly. They have a certain percentage of them that are –
why do they come here to learn to fly? Why don't they learn over there?
I have a pilot's license as well. Part of my extreme sports.
Yep.
they come here because a lot of the airspace in China – is not open. So you got about 70% of it. So they have really no general aviation community.
You can't practice.
So that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they come here, and then on top of that, something people don't really consider is the language. Because in flight, it has to be in English. It's either English or Japanese.
Yeah, so you guys better learn here and hear all the accents from the towers and all that.
International flights, if you're going to fly, you better know how to learn. Not only that, but if you've ever listened to the communication between the tower or even pilot to pilot, it's very fast. It's shorthand.
It's almost a different language.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you're not really good at listening in a foreign language or speaking and knowing exactly, precisely what you're doing, you know, it brings up the level of potential hazard for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was in a small plane a couple months ago, and you know, everybody in a small plane has to wear the headphones and listen to all the stuff. And I speak, you know, I mean, I've spoken English for 61 years, and I'm listening to this guy in the tower, and it was like a Reading tower. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, what did that guy say? I mean, most of what he was telling the guy to do, I had no idea what he was saying.
And we're landing on the taxiway.
And it was just like, blah, 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 and it was like, what did he say? It was just weird.
It can get scary.
That's really one of the only times I've done that, because most of the time you're in a big plane and they don't let you listen to what's going on, which is probably good. You feel safer. Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, that explains the pilots. There are a lot of people who think, oh, they just sent him here to spy on us.
No. They really need that in order to build up their domestic as well, but predominantly international.
Interesting.
And like I said, I've seen a lot of things change in China. I was very blessed, like I said, fortunate to be there. And then the time I was there, there were cities just being developed like crazy. And you probably heard the stories or seen on TV where there's cities being built in the middle of nowhere for 20 million people.
Yeah, and then nobody moves in.
Well, they have, but they planned it. The Chinese do really long-range strategic planning. And I was in a Guizhou province, and when I first landed there many years ago, it took a five-hour trip along along the hillside to get there. And within about 2 years, they built a highway and tunnels, and they tunnel and everything because there's no environmental report. There's no worry about property.
Tunnel.
They just go wherever they want to go.
Right.
So all of it's really quick. And they built some of the tallest, about half of the world's tallest bridges are in China. And they just tunneled like crazy. So now when you go there, it takes an hour instead of 5 hours along the river. But all the people along the river, just like the Erie Canal, created transportation and everybody moved. But that's what's happening. All those people are moving out of those areas because there's no more merchant, you know, activity.
Right? Yeah, sure. Everybody blows right by them.
Because it's all up there on the mountainside.
Yep.
Right.
So that's what they were planning for.
Fascinating. Huh. Kind of a fun perspective on all this. I did find a song for the tests.
Oh, you did?
The Chinese tests.
I like it.
Yeah. It was the only thing I could think of. Billy Joel kind of got it. So Professor Dan Sloan is our guest. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only had to run so far, so good. But you will come to a place where the only thing you feel are loaded guns in your face, and you'll have to deal with.
Seeing foreign cars filled with fuel, it isn't ours. And wearing cotton we didn't grow. He's got the red, white, blue, blind hound farm. Semper Fi tattooed on his left arm. Spent a little more in the store for a tag. In the back it says USA. He won't buy nothing that he can't fix. With WD-40 and a Craftsman wrench, he ain't prejudiced.
Okay, so tell people about the climate change when you have to explain it in China.
Oh, well,
not to skip that over, but
yeah,
we got to talk about that during the break.
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing you have to really think about is what do the words climate change mean, and when you ask Americans, they're not sure.
Yeah.
You know, and then you talk about anthropogenic climate change, which is human-caused climate change, and studies and academia likes to come out with. So generally what I'll do is start out with trying to define what climate means, and then change obviously is different. So, and it's a different experience with most people. They think it's weather or something else. So I'll go into, well, how much of the climate is that so-called anthropogenic? Human cause, and how much of it is natural, you know, volcanoes and weather and all the atmospheric reactions that we have. And I'll go around the room. You have 20, 30 people, 50 people. And I've had as many as, I don't know, I just had 8,000 online. So large numbers of people, and ask them that question, you know, how much, what percentage, and let them vote. So normally it's at least 2-4% up to 100%. You know, the answers I receive back. So I'll tell me, oh, yeah. So then I say, okay, we have consensus. Climate change is real. You all voted saying it's real. It has, to some degree, impacted our weather or whatever. And people don't think of it that way. That's when they have those studies that come out and say, you know, we have climate consensus that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Between 2% and 100%.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we have to define the word consensus, don't we?
Yeah. So then it gets into, you know, what does it mean for your country? And China is just notorious for cheating. You know, we all know that. So there's all kinds of issues that come up there where we have something called AQI, Air Quality Index, and you have it on your phone. It's an app. You can constantly look at it and see how bad the weather is outside. When you go in to have a, like we have these climate change forums that are going on now, there's agreements that are being had, and developing countries are given priority and waivers and all kinds of opportunities. And China happens to be a developing country that has a moon station, a very large military, largest
Navy.
That
part is bogus. They're a developing country.
Yeah. So you look at that and you go, okay, and what they just agreed to in the latest, I was watching the news on it this morning, was that China was going to, and this is what I've been talking to my Chinese colleagues about, is that they are in agreement that they want to be the leader in climate change. They do.
Hmm.
Because they want to prevent everybody else from polluting. Otherwise, their manufacturing will go away.
Uh-huh.
Make it all here so you can meet your climate goals.
Yeah, and, we can pollute, but you can't.
And we'll let you know how we're doing
with
our magic science.
And unfortunately, and people are going to chastise me probably for this, for saying, oh, climate change. And I'm not – as far as I know, and what most people who speak other languages, what they can identify with is something tangible. So when I start talking about pollution – they get it. If there's no pollution, there's no anthropogenic climate change. You know, that does, you'd have to kill off everybody on Earth in order, sure, not to have biological or other hazards from the human race. But that kind of brings it to reality. You know, what are we doing individually in order to cause some kind of pollution that translates into a change in our climate? And then is it changing or not? Now, most people have a really difficult time with all those issues, but the Chinese look at it as an opportunity to earn a lot of income.
Yeah.
I've seen the AQI as high as 1,000, which is huge. It's like 30 most of the time in most cities in America. And it's extremely hazardous sometimes. And I say during the winter is when it's like that the most in some cities.
Well, it was painfully obvious during the Olympics, when the Olympics were in China. I mean, they were actually concerned about the athletes having to breathe the air over there.
Yeah, you wear a mask every day. Yeah. So wearing a mask is something I did for many, many years. And I lived in Wuhan, you know, and I know what the communist environment is like there. Very interesting as well. And you were asking me something about the issues that are happening today as far as Russia and China and those things. And we got into a little bit about the history of the dollar and what's happening with that. And from what I've seen at the beginning of this year, from February until May, I presented 8 seminars and had to do it online because of COVID and other restrictions and because of where it was at. The seminars were at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, and it was piped in there and then rebroadcast to the law schools throughout Russia, and had 1,500 students originally, but before it even began, I had 8,000, and it went up from there.
Wow.
So a very large audience. Felt so incredibly blessed to have an opportunity to touch so many lives for people who, you know, some of your listeners might be shocked that I'm giving presentations for the Department of State from Redding, California in Russia during a time of war. But it all gets back to those issues of the dollar. And as far as I see it, in my opinion, that is predominantly the reason why we are kind of in a proxy war. You know, we have Ukraine fighting a war, and it's because of the dollar that Putin wants to get paid in his currency, in the ruble. And the reason he wants to get paid in the ruble and revalue, going back to what we were talked about before, about how we went to the petrodollar in 1973. We had 9/11. We shifted to manufacturing, bringing in lower cost goods in order to survive for our economy. The petrodollar was put into place because we were going to protect our oil producing allies, Saudi Arabia being the predominant. Now we've, through the Biden administration, have cut off a lot of the oil producing segments of our domestic economy. So pipelines were canceled, restrictions put in place. And in California, we have the rules that are coming out that we're going to have electric vehicles by 2035, right? So we're going to have electric vehicles. So we've cut off our...
That's
what they think. Yeah. We're using the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, you know, draining that. We've reduced the amount of supply globally, caused a lot of inflation and problems here in our economy. At the same time, we're asking our oil allies to give us a deal. You know, we're going to put you out of business by 2035, but can you just give us a deal until then? And then we've got Putin saying these are our minerals under our soil.
What a novel idea.
And we want to get paid in our currency. We don't like sanctions. And you may not agree with what we do, and I don't. But if we, you may not agree with us, but that's how we want to be paid, because we don't want to have you telling us what we can and cannot do. We want control. And that's the same thing with China. You've got them producing, by far, the largest manufacturer, you know, and they're saying we want to get paid in our currency, and we don't want to be beholding to you. So the two of them together, along with our allies that are now kind of questioning what could happen to their livelihood when a large percentage of their GDP is being produced off of a product that we no longer want to exist. And what will they do then?
Mm-hmm.
So there's some... And the answer to that is freedom, what we came to before, is the people in every country around the world that I've been to want the same things. They want freedom. And if freedom opens up all kinds of things, opportunity, travel, you know, to say what they choose, believe what they want. The Ukrainian people are proving how far people will go to retain their freedom. They would rather die than lose it. So when it comes down to a tyrant, and then tyrants don't get along. Again, going back to they don't like competition. So once you select a tyrant, they're going to be in a fight with a different tyrant in another country, and you end up with all those issues. But the American dollar is really where it's at. And as long as we keep printing dollars, you'll see some stability. And that's what Minsky, I mentioned earlier, had come to the conclusion, is that there's instability. And what he meant by that is we would keep printing money to stay stable, which would create instability.
And it has.
And that's what's happening. We've reached a point to where if we stop printing, there's countries around the world, Laos being one of them where I was for a year, they're landlocked. They don't have any ocean ports. And there are 7 million people. 80% of them are rice farmers. Okay. And they're getting a huge chunk of climate change money, okay, for reparations and, you know, whatever problems that perceived or not. So, like I said, defining climate change, you come back to these people have no P in their GDP. Mm-hmm. There's no productivity.
Right.
And GNI is based upon not just productivity, GDP, but also those dollars that are coming in, they're being, you know, expatriated, repatriated, that are coming from dollars earned outside, people earning an income and sending some home, investment income, interest, and all those things coming in. And as soon as you get rid of that opportunity to bring in American dollars or capital, those countries will fold.
Oh, they'll fold right now.
Or go to revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And well, see what they can do.
Again, back to the instability. So we've got a couple of, like 2.5 minutes left, but I wanted you to tie Russia and China, that battle that we're looking at, because we were talking about it in the break, and we're cheating the listeners out of that.
Well, what's happening is Russia is seen as a gas station. You know, their economy is that's basically what it is. Okay,
international gas
station. Vodka, but you know they don't have a lot like China does in terms of their production. Manufacturing and China has just done a phenomenal job at taking our capital and putting it to use in a more militarized environment. So they're watching. The Chinese are extraordinarily patient people, long-term, long-range planning, and they're watching everything that we are doing, that the Ukrainians, the Russians are doing. They'll observe that, and they won't make the same mistakes. And Taiwan is their ultimate goal, at least in the short run, is to take over Taiwan. There's the 9-dash line, which is the South China Sea, that they are claiming as their territory. And I've actually given presentations on a military base down in southern China, have seen how their people look at everything out there, the ocean. The Chinese construction companies are owned by the communist government, and they're the ones that do the construction of deep seawater ports. So they'll they're in there building them, loaning the money, and they're doing it at very high interest rates that are almost impossible to repay. And then they'll reclaim that property.
Then they call the loan.
That's handy.
Call the loan, and then they've got a seaport for their navy.
Mm-hmm. And so you figure between the two, between, I hate to spoiler alert, but between Russia and China, you figure the Chinese will let the Russians make the, you know, be the aggressors against us. They'll sit back and watch what didn't work.
Play all sides.
And then slide in behind.
And they, like I said, they'll do
that
whatever they're going
to
do with a lot of forethought and a lot of strength.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
do it quickly.
Our guest has been Professor Dan Sloan. He is over at Simpson University here in beautiful Redding, California, and wealth of information. I'm sure that we will be begging you to come back and just have more of this discussion. You're listening
Absolutely.
To We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Our glasses, things are going great, and they're only getting better.